goals, to practices, the kinds of relationships that help lead to solutions. But we could see that solutions achieved in one sphere could be applied to another, so that rule of law, so important in international justice, also can be important in accountability in healthcare, so that legal regulations that limit the legal rights to litigation of individuals in relation to companies are really wrong. And so there are legal remedies that can be pursued through legislation and through other kinds of civil action. And that also, of course, works with trusts, overarching trusts, and the limitation of competition. We have legal remedies for that, which are actually being pursued. So that's one angle. I don't know if that answers your question, but it shows a direction.
We can say, by the way, that the need for integrating different kinds of activities is illustrated by membership in civil society organizations. Many of us belong to organizations that argue for better preservation of the natural environment. Others may belong to organizations that are concerned with population problems. Others may belong to organizations that argue for greater foreign assistance to developing countries. Others may be interested in issues of war and peace. But in fact, these things are all so closely related that it's extremely difficult to act in any one of these domains without affecting the others. So we really need to have realization, more understanding of the interrelations.
The question of the multilateral corporations, of course, is a very important question. And it's a little bit, if I can make the analogy with armed conflict, if business is of that nature, what you want to develop is new rules of engagement. And the new rules of engagement will range along a very wide spectrum of issues. You have the question of corruption. Example, the U.S. legislation on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, where you can't pay bribes to obtain business in certain sectors. You have other areas in which you can see already extensive regulations, such as in the EU, whether it is in anti-competitiveness or other European Union laws and regulations that apply to business, both business from within the union and business from outside the union trying to come in. I think that what we need to identify is a set of issues which we agree upon are global issues. They may relate to protection of the environment. They may relate to labor practices. They may relate, for example, to non-employment of children or prison labor or slave labor. There are some minimum rules that I think we can elevate to an international level that can then be prescribed by an international system and then applied by national and regional systems. But we're still at the beginning of this new experiment because we don't know how the transnational corporation, which is not only the Microsofts of the world, but also the small businesses which do business internationally. There is another dimension to it, which is, of course, very important, particularly in the era of globalization of the economic and financial system, is you have to recall that the globalization is also the conduit to money laundering, and that the proceeds of crime, mostly from the traffic of drugs, and we're speaking of approximately $500 billion a year, goes through the financial system of the world. And if we want to address the problem of trafficking in drugs and organized crime and crime on the streets, we cannot ignore the business component through which the money is being laundered and reinvested. And so that's another dimension that I think needs to be examined when we are trying to establish some international controls. Merle?
In education, it so often happens that a very narrow view of the core of education prevails. And when resources are short, the things that are cut out are a entirely the wrong things. For example, the arts. Arts education is one of the first things to disappear when funds for schools prove to be inadequate. The same is true of many other important activities. And instead, we should be elevating the arts to a very high position, I think, in the hierarchy of subjects that are involved in education.
Because where do the values come from? Where are they discussed? But in the coursework and in people's response to literature and creativity in the arts and the humanities. So even though Murray is a physicist, he like all of us, recognized the importance of this aspect of society over and above science and technology.
I think you can't minimize the tremendous impact of the Internet on the globalization of art and literature and music, for better or for worse. You can go off to a remote village in Laos, I'm exaggerating for the sake of emphasis, and find a guy painting pictures that look like copies of Picasso because he somehow got them on the Internet. You can find, I'm just speaking about the places, I mean, you can sit on a street corner in Bangkok and see kids coming down the street with guitars imitating Elvis Presley. These are not exactly the highest forms, if you want. But it's amazing.
Where did you say the local star was named Elvis Fung?
Yeah, in Saigon there's a rock star called Elvis Fung. I was recently in a little town in the highlands of South Vietnam. It used to be called South Vietnam. And there's a cafe there called the Stop and Go Cafe where all the artists and poets and writers get together. And they all wear berets and they have goatees like they're sitting in cafes on the Boulevard Montparnasse. They speak French. Their paintings are terrible. I thought their poetry was awful. Maybe Nikki would. I'm going to send her there. She may like it. They're marvelous. They're marvelous fun to be with. In other words, there are no borders anymore. It's just quite extraordinary. And one other thing just to add to that, there is, again, thanks to the Internet, and there's a kind of international youth culture which is similar. I mean, the kids are all, I mean, I'm speaking as a septuagenarian, but the kids all know what they all know what they're all doing everywhere in the world, and they all speak the kind of the same language, and they all listen to the same music, and so forth. One more point about this is, American influence in this respect, for better or for worse, is quite phenomenal. I mean, I must say, I don't find any anti-Americanism outside of France. I don't find any. And even in France, it's only a pocket. It's only a pocket of intellectuals. So I think this is a very important aspect of this globalization trend.
Let me add a sort of a dissenting note here, if I may. I'm not really sure that it's an encouraging sign to have the world sort of copy the various fads that are produced in America, whether it's music, food, or dress. I am concerned, however, with the fact that most governments in the world, particularly developing countries, allocate less than 5% of their budget to education. And frequently 50 to 60% of their budget to defense. Of the 5% maximum allocated to education, you will find no more than an average of maybe less than a fraction of 1% allocated to humanities and the arts. Now, the question I ask is, if generation after generation we produce people who, like machines, are more capable to work better, produce more, and so on, and are not people who are thinkers and who are feelers, what sort of a humanity are we developing into? And so my concern in that respect is the degradation of the interests on the part of governments and societies in supporting the humanities and the arts because, as Anna was saying, this is where values are being communicated. And if not, then we would have these, particularly for those who are going to be the more vulnerable segments of our society, because it will naturally lead to the survival of the fittest. And that's not what a civilization should tend to.
A related matter has to do with the preservation of cultural diversity. I think Sherif was a few human generations, the results of biological evolution over hundreds of millions of years, creating biological diversity. So it's equally crazy to see different ways of living on the earth as a human being. And yet there are many paradoxes in the preservation of cultural diversity, because for one thing, the other side of that coin is ethnic hatred. And one has to encourage a cultural diversity within a kind of unity and solidarity, not so much in terms of violent competition. For another thing, certain trends, certain cultural trends are hostile to other things that we need to preserve, freedom, environmental quality, and so on and so on. There are many cultural traditions that are contrary to those values. So there are a number of paradoxes and difficulties. But despite all of that, the preservation of cultural diversity is worthwhile. In the case of indigenous peoples, an organic kind of modernization that leaves large chunks of cultural heritage in place is far preferable to a kind of sudden displacement into a some slum periphery of modern civilization.
Yes, and as many people who live in the Southwest know, much of the cultural homogenization and the effacement of regional traditions has come under force. So the people were required to speak only English in Indian schools, and traditions were outlawed, religious traditions. So I think that if we understand the historical context of some of the changes that are more adverse, then we can have more confidence that allowing cultural diversity to flourish is a positive good for all humanity.
Wow. We all sort of got airborne here, didn't we? Let me do Tom here.
I don't believe there was any conflict, but there were things we left out, but I don't believe there was conflict.
First of all, I'm the only member of color, and I'm